and welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Michael Polignano. This week, we continue with part two of our interview with traditionalist author Charles Upton.
The interfaith movement basically works to unify religion, not in terms of appreciating a transcendent unity of it, but rather in what? In blunting worldly religious differences, in making people, as you said, schmooze with one another and not compete for converts. How is the interfaith movement kind of profane image of the idea of transcendent the transcendent unity of religion?
Well, it's a unity that is not transcendent. It's a worldly unity. But it's also a very abstract and in some ways meaningless idea of unity because, what do we mean by unity? I mean, is unity good? I mean, the idea that people have, well, if we're not all one, then we'll all be fighting. Don't they remember that there's a great diversity in life because manifestations are different, that doesn't mean they have to be at war with each other? You know, this is forgotten. The unity means to a lot of people in the interfaith movement peace and amity. But it could just as well mean, let's say, one trend is the desire to federate the different religions under a non-religious authority or a secular authority. That's a kind of unity. But is this a unity that furthers the goals and the purposes of any religion? It is not. Now, it wasn't long ago I phoned up the Council on Foreign Relations because I just wanted to see what I could turn up talking to the receptionist, you know. And I was talking about some of these ideas, and she kept saying, well, no, I officially cannot comment. One of the things actually I found on that website was an article about an Ali Etteratz, whoever he is. And this was a couple of years ago, and he was taking as a well-known fact, because it had been reported in a lot of the world press, that now the globalist think tanks were turning to Sufism and saying, well, Sufism is a tolerant and peaceful form of Islam that we can support as an alternative to the Islamic extremists. You know, that is co-optation right there. I mean, what Sufism has to do is avoid both the kind of overtures that the interfaith movement, with a lot of backing from the State Department and the globalist think tanks and people like that, are making to them, saying, come and represent a tolerant Islam that can get along with the other religions. That sounds very nice, but it's simply a vector of control, because patronage is control. They need to avoid that, and they also need to avoid the temptation to move in the direction of Islamic extremism, which Sufis basically, if your nation is invaded and everybody has to take arms and protect the town, the Sufis will not shirk that duty. But insofar as having a political agenda, this is foreign to Sufism. Sufism has degenerated in that direction sometimes, but it's foreign to the essence of Sufism. You know, as foreign as it would be to Christian monasticism, although we can see that Christian monastics also have had that tendency.
Well, there were armed Christian monastic orders. Were there not armed Sufi groups that carried out political struggles armed with daggers and swords against their opponents? Is that always a degeneration?
This is true, but this is not what the essence of Sufism is. I mean, any group that's constituted under a leader and that has a certain degree of independence, can become transformed into a political cadre. That is, and in so doing, lose its true character. This can happen. What's happening now, for example, let's see, the Naqshbandi Sufis, I hear on my Yahoo news page, at one point got a brigade together and were fighting the Americans in Iraq. But on the other hand, Craig Murray, who was I'm just getting this from the web, and I don't know this independently, but this is what I find on the web. Craig Murray former British ambassador to Uzbekistan was talking about how certain Sufis are running around saying there is no religious oppression in Uzbekistan. And he says, I beg to differ. If anybody in Uzbekistan, Muslim, is found with a Quran, found fasting during Ramadan, praying in their own house, not doing this through the state mosques, they go to the gulag. You know, they go to the, you know, and are tortured. And yet there are certain Sufis whom I will not name who are running around saying, oh, there's no, you're telling a lot of people and talking to legislators and such and saying, we can assure you there's no religious repression in Uzbekistan. So, you know, one of the problems with Sufism now is it's being penetrated by a lot of political forces, some of them coming from the Muslim world, some of them coming from Western intelligence. And thank God there are Sufis who are entirely free of this. You know, but and beyond Sufism, I'm of the increasing belief that every religion is in the sights of the powers that be for some kind of infiltration or control.
Right.
What better way to control large masses of people? And I'm bringing out instances of this in my book.
Well, George Soros, Bill Gates, Hewlett Packard, whatever their agendas in supporting interfaith initiatives, they're certainly not trying to engineer a closer encounter with God.
That's correct. They're trying to engineer something.
Yeah, they're trying to use religion to create a pacified world that breaks down any kind of identities that people take seriously enough to shed blood over or prohibit usury or close borders to international trade. And there's the agenda is really a global religion, so there can be a global market and a global governance, and ultimately, I think, a global blended, you know, miscegenated humanity. I think those are clear agenda items of the people who run things. And it strikes me that one of the dangers of initiatic spiritual orders is, or any kind of hierarchy for that matter, even if it's a military thing, is that if you can penetrate it, if you could corrupt it at the top, you can have people who are acting in perfectly good faith and thinking that they're, you know, doing the will of God, that they're engineering a better world and getting themselves closer to God, and they're actually serving quite the opposite. And one of the things that struck me in your book is your discussion of Freemasonry as one of these vectors of counter-initiation. But it strikes me that any hierarchy with unknown superiors is ripe for that kind of takeover and subversion.
Any hierarchy, including the Catholic Church. I mean, I'm afraid in the Pope's encyclical Caritas in Veritate, he called for a one-world government. And then there was this paper that was put out later, not long ago, by the Pontifical Council on Justice and Peace, which essentially said we need a one-world banking system as a step toward a one-world government. Now, this is the Vatican talking. This is his guys. This is not. These are not loose cannons. This is official Vatican document. And not only that, but they used the Tower of Babel not as an example of a false world spirituality or religious imperialism that was nixed by God, that was nipped in the bud by God because it was against his will, but as the example of the failure of unity because there was divisiveness. In other words, they were saying if only the Tower of Babel could really have succeeded, we would have had a better world. And forgetting that it was God himself in Genesis who by his will confused the tongues of the people so that the Tower of Babel would fail, would not be completed. I mean, if you want to talk about counter-initiation, that is an inversion, a direct inversion of Scripture, of the clear meaning of Scripture in order to support a one-world banking system and a one-world government.
There's a very interesting book by a couple of, one's a sociologist, one's a political scientist. It's called The Struggle for the World by Charles Lindholm, and I think his name is Pedro Zuqueta. And it's about anti-globalization movements around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the chapters in there, much to my surprise, was a very respectful discussion of the European New Right as a counter-globalization movement.
Oh, it's pretty clear that that's what was going on. You know, I fear that one can include Hitler in that as well.
Well, yeah, all forms of ethno-nationalism are counter-globalization. And what we stand for, what Countercurrents is about, really, is in North America, we'd like to create a little intellectual outpost for the European New Right, which basically takes the view that we have a personal interest because we have our own culture, our own race, our own history, and our own destiny. We would like to preserve that distinctness, but we also want really everybody to have a fighting chance at preserving that diversity. And if you want to call it God-given, looking at the Tower of Babel episode, I mean, the Tower of Babel shows that the attempt to unify man and storm the heavens was squelched by what? The confusion of tongues, the creation
yes.
of many peoples.
Yeah, and that was God's will.
That was the will of God. You can look at it from a Darwinian point of view if you want. It's a scientist and say, look, natural diversity is there. That's a good. It's a natural good.
Yeah, racial diversity is an aspect of biodiversity, if you will.
And then there's cultural and religious diversity. And one of the things that I am very drawn to about traditionalism, and it has resonated with me very deeply, I came to it through Evola. I came to Guénon through Evola because he appealed to me as a rightist. But one of the things that I think is very important about what real traditionalism can do is it can affirm the diversity of different ways of life, different peoples, different ethnic and racial and religious divisions among the world, and yet at the same time establish that place sort of above the clouds. In his book, The Plumed Serpent, D.H. Lawrence tells a story of an Irish woman who goes to Mexico and meets this fellow who is a group of people who are Mexican nationalists who are trying to revive the Aztec religion.
Uh-huh.
And there's this discussion about how at the peaks of all these different peoples, there can be a kind of unity. It's like the people follow the different paths to the mountaintop and the sages can communicate. I think that's a very important possibility.
Yeah, it is important. I mean, these themes were dealt with by Fritjof Schoen in a book called Castes and Races, which you may be interested in. But when it comes to the Aztec religion, I fear that any religion that has to start wars in order to capture many captives, to tear out thousands of hearts upon the altars of these pyramids in order to keep the sun from going out, has got some problems with it.
I would agree with that, yeah.
And, you know, you have to go back at least to the Toltecs. I mean, there was a Toltec king called Seacatl Quetzalcoatl. He's one of the kings who was, you know, given the epithet Plumed Serpent, you know, or was named after or was a servant of that god. And he was a little bit like Akhenaten in Egypt. Essentially, human sacrifice was going on, and what he was trying to do was return to the idea of self-sacrifice. He would do very fierce austerities and, you know, bleed himself and do whatever, you know, was done at that time, you know, in order to atone for the sins of his people, in order to try to overcome the regime of human sacrifice, which he failed to do. The priests of Tezcatlipoca, the jaguar priests, triumphed, and he was exiled. But if you go back to, or forward, but if you look at the way sacrifice is done, say, in the North American Plains tribes in the Sundance, you will see something akin to what Seacatl Quetzalcoatl was trying to reestablish, I believe. The idea that, you know, the sacrifice, you make the sacrifice. You're the one who bleeds. You know, you dance with a splint of wood stuck through the flesh of your chest in the hot sun, fasting and not drinking, you know, with that splint tied to a leather thong that's tied to the central pole. And you dance, and sometimes it's pulled, you know, free, tearing itself out of your chest, and you undergo this suffering in order to atone for the sins of the people and to bring God's, you know, the favor of the Great Spirit on the people. This was the original, I think, spirituality that later degenerated into these various blood cults where you sacrifice somebody else.
I think the idea of the offering the heart, the literal heart to the gods,
yeah,
could be a kind of crude way of understanding.
Oh, yes. Faith. Human sacrifice is a literalization of the sacrifice of the ego.
Exactly. Exactly. And
and thereby it becomes counter-initiatory because it's an inversion as well.
Right. And one of the things that I thought was most lucid in your book was the chapter on the difference between religion and magic. And then the way I would put it is that true religion is always about making your will accept reality, understood
yes.
as the will of God, whereas false religion, and that includes superstition and magic, is an attempt by you to impose your will upon
yes.
reality or God. Nuns tell school children, now say your Hail Marys so the bus won't crash or something like that.
We can always petition God. We are directed to petition God, but we have to say not my will but thine be done.
Yeah, exactly. But the idea of magic is that you can somehow command God, control
yeah.
reality.
It makes God passive and the human subject active, which is an inversion.
Yeah, yeah. And that inversion takes place even within genuine religions. It's sort of a perennial temptation for human beings to try and assert control over the gods. I remember Hegel in his Philosophy of World History talks about African cult figures and talks about how if deity didn't deliver, the priests would beat it or burn it
yes.
you know, to punish it, you know, because it wasn't performing its function, and so it
right.
it had to be flogged, which is pure inversion of religiosity.
Yes. And not very effective either, by the way.
Yeah, it didn't bring the rain either, but at least made people feel a little better about the fact, I imagine.
But, you know, getting back to the idea of the beauties of diversity, I want to say, I know you noticed you used the word miscegenation, and I first want to say it is wonderful that still on this earth we have pure types like the blondest of the Swedes, or the Watusis, incredible beings, you know, and in the 60s, when I was down in Yucatan, you had a pure race of the Mayans still living there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was down at Chichen Itza with a bunch of tourists, and there was this lady and her daughter were walking along, Americans, and she was saying, they were actually quite advanced for their time. But what no one seems to know is whatever happened to them. And then I look around and say, everybody else in the plaza are Mayans. I mean, they have precisely the same physiognomy as on the bas-reliefs.
Yeah.
There they are. That's one of the purest races I've ever seen. Like we say, all Chinese look alike. Boy, you could not mistake a Mayan.
Mm-hmm.
Downturned. Ah, get very emotional about this. Downturned mouth, which they call a jaguar mouth, skull slightly, slightly backward. What do you say?
Sort of elongated.
Elongated, but also in the backward direction, like you will see in some Egyptian skulls.
Right, right.
And that was exaggerated by putting the baby's heads within boards so the skull would look more like that. But, you know, that was exaggeration of already a racial trait. And, you know, the really triangular chin, and the Roman nose. I mean, they all just pure Mayans. Then Mel Gibson came along with this movie, Apocalypto, and I looked and I said, those people aren't Mayans anymore. Now, maybe he just wasn't getting them from the, you know, the inland area where the race was still pure, because he got a lot of people from the docks, you know, for extras in that movie. And I'm saying, these are all a bunch of half-breeds. These aren't the Mayans I remember from the 60s, you know. So, and it's very sad when pure racial types like you know, different animal species or different varieties of plants will disappear. On the other hand, there's another side to it, which is when Malcolm X became a real Muslim, not just a, you know, a black Muslim, as invented by Elijah Muhammad, which was a pretty weird belief system. And he went on the Hajj to Mecca, and this is the first time he says, all these people are Muslims. I mean, look, they're people whiter than as white as the whitest people in America, and there's people blacker than me, and there's everything in between. And all these people are Muslims. And at this point is when his thinking began to go beyond the simple demonization of white people and you know, develop a more sophisticated analysis of what was wrong between the races and what was wrong in this country. And because his thinking was changing like that, that's one of the reasons he was probably assassinated.
Right. I've never read his autobiography, but I did see the Spike Lee movie, and I found that whole element in there very moving and very touching. And I can see, you know, the appeal of these universalistic religions that offer a kind of brotherhood of mankind. Yeah. And the great trick, and one of the things that I think is so powerful about traditionalism, is it can do both. It can provide a sense that there is a transcendent unity, and yet that there are many valid spiritual paths, and that different peoples can therefore remain different, but look upon one another not as enemies, as in some sense brother humans, brother initiates,
and appreciate each other's differences. I mean, when you look at situations like, you know, Bosnia and Sarajevo.
Right.
People live together, Muslims, Christians, live together in complete amity, you know, understanding this is, you know, it's no more would there be war between the Muslims and Christians in Sarajevo than there would be, let's say, you know, an all-out war between the Italians and the Irish in New York. You know what I mean? At least between the Jews and the Irish, let us say. There are always skirmishes. There's always, you know, an edge of prejudice. But look how long people of different religions and races have been able to live together in New York. What happened in Sarajevo was you know, it was inflamed by people who had a political purpose for doing so. Or Seyed Hossein Nasr, who's a Persian Iranian, who's one of he's probably the most preeminent expositor of the traditional school now, although he tends to speak entirely as a Muslim, which is his right and his duty, actually. He said, when I was growing up in Iran, there was no prejudice between Christians, Muslims, and Jews. It was not heard of. You know, that all this comes after the revolution. In fact, I want to read you something. This comes in at this point. There you hear my call to prayer from my software. I'm allowed to wait until, you know, a little while. So this is, I don't know if you've heard this before, this is a letter. It was dictated by the Prophet Muhammad, and it was written down by Ali, because Muhammad couldn't write. But Ali was his scribe, and so he wrote it down. And it's a letter. And it's actually a charter of rights that was sent to the ancient monastery of St. Catherine's in the Sinai, ancient Christian monastery. And he says, this is a message from Muhammad ibn Abdullah as a covenant to those who adopt Christianity near and far. We are with them. Verily I, the servants, the helpers, and my followers defend them, because Christians are my citizens. and by Allah, I hold out against anything that displeases them. No compulsion is to be on them. Neither are their judges to be removed from their jobs, nor their monks from their monasteries. No one is to destroy a house of their religion, to damage it, or carry anything from it to the Muslims' houses. Should anyone take any of these, he would spoil God's covenant and disobey his prophet. Verily, they are my allies and have my secure charter against all that they hate. No one is to force them to travel or to oblige them to fight. The Muslims are to fight for them. If a female Christian is married to a Muslim, it is not to take place without her approval. She is not to be prevented from visiting her church to pray. Their churches are to be respected. They are neither to be prevented from repairing them nor the sacredness of their covenants. No one of the nation is to disobey the covenant to the last day. Now, how different that is from the way Christians are treated by so many of these Wahhabi-influenced Muslims today. How incredibly different. Well, the Wahhabis never respected the Sunnah of the Prophet anyway. So it's not surprising.
Well, Charles, I think that this has been a very, very good conversation. I know you've got to go. Are there any last thoughts that you would like to share? And we'd certainly like you to plug your book again.
Well, yeah, like, instead of reading that thing I said I was going to read, I think I'd rather plug my book.
Good.
Okay, it's called Vectors of the Counter-Initiation. You can get it at Amazon or on...
It's published by Sophia Perennis.
Published by Sophia Perennis this year. You can also get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it in the UK at amazon.co.uk. And I'm just going to quickly go through the chapter titles. That's probably the best way to get it, because this book covers a lot of territory. Well, what is the counter-initiation? We've dealt with that. Vigilance in the interfaith arena, we pretty much dealt with that. Traditional versus counter-traditional perspectives on the divine feminine and the sacredness of nature, which has a lot to do with what is valid or invalid in neo-paganism. This talks a lot about some of the more radical proposals of the depopulationists to forcibly reduce the human population by billions. So they've said some very frightening things. And I'm opposing the false pagan view, which is basically a materialistic or glamorized materialistic view of the natural world, to the kind of understanding of the sacredness of nature that would come directly out of Islam and the Quran. Magic and tasawwuf, tasawwuf is Sufism. We've basically dealt with it. We were talking about when I was critiquing magic. The fall of the jinn, well, that's a mythological tour de force about who the jinn were and are vis-a-vis the gods. In many different religions, in Norse religion you have the Aesir of the gods and the Jotun of the giants. In Hinduism you have the Asuras, who are basically the titans, and the devas were the gods. In Greek religion you have the gods and the titans, etc., etc. What that's all about. Now, UFOs, mass mind control, and the awliya al-shaitan. This is one of my favorite chapters because we are living in a control system. It is incredible the amount of consciously constructed, but not consciously understood, propaganda is coming out of popular culture and of every media outlet in this world. And this is talking about the UFO phenomenon, which I consider to be a true paranormal phenomenon, which is being used by the powers that be in order to effect a paradigm shift away from the traditional religions. It does, among other things, analysis of post-World War II cinema and how this is very consciously created propaganda in order to make us believe in UFOs. The idea is that the government is hiding what it knows about UFOs. That's the cover story. The real intent is to disseminate disbelief in a covert manner. In 1962, Douglas MacArthur, speaking before the cadets at West Point at a commencement, said that our next war would be between a united Earth and an enemy from another galaxy. This is what he said. And he says, and it's up to you to fight this war. young soldiers. You know, and I made sure that he actually said that. So he let the cat out of the bag. The UFO myth as it's being created is in the service of one world government. Either that they're helpful, you know, philosophers from beyond the stars who will teach us to be at peace with each other and live in a united world, or they're an enemy that we have to unite against in order to fight. So that's all about that. Now, the next one is the real Rumi, which is talking about the well-known Sufi poet Rumi, who's been put to the worst possible use as a patron of interfaith, and his whole Muslim nature is being denied, and it's all about that. Then there's a chink in the perennialist armor. Perennialists, by the way, are another name that's coming to be used for the traditionalists. Uncertainty as to the principial unity of knowledge and love. This is one of my beefs I have with the traditionalists, is that they weren't entirely sure that God was love as well as truth. So I'm trying to write that, trying to fix that. So then there's an interview with me called Drug-Induced Mysticism Revisited. It's by Samuel Bendix Sotillos, who interviewed me about my experiences with LSD, you know, and other things that were going on in the counterculture. And boy, did he come up with. He has extensive footnotes, which tell so much about what was happening with LSD, which, of course, was given to us by the CIA through their MK-Ultra mind control program. No question about that. They were producing millions of doses because they wanted to disseminate it throughout the entire society, which they did. And getting back to the Freemasons, the new round of psychedelic research in academia was spearheaded in part by the Scottish Rite Foundation for Schizophrenia Research, the head of which, whose name escapes me, was also at that time the head of the NIMH, National Institutes for Mental Health, you know, the top of the federal mental health system. And it's through these people, among others, that the psychedelic research came back into academia in the 90s. This is interesting. Then I'm talking about the Templars and the Freemasons as true initiatic orders who, because they had separated themselves from their parent religions or in some other way become corrupt and inverted, went over to the counter-initiation later. So, you know, I have The Fall of Lucifer. You'll have to read that one. I have something on transhumanism and the war against religion, the idea we should all be cybernetic robots. And then there's a few appendices. One, a letter to Henry Mackow, who is a very interesting conspiracy theorist. I don't believe everything he said, but I don't believe everything anybody said. I think his books are worth considering, books on the Illuminati. And you have to follow his, if you want to evaluate him, follow his leads and do your own research and see if you agree with him. One of the interesting things, by the way, he likes to emphasize is that there's a lot of collaboration between the Zionists and the Nazis. Because most of the Jews before World War II in Germany wanted to assimilate. They wanted to be good Germans. They wanted to get rid of their Jewishness. And this was not going to be of help to the Zionists in founding the State of Israel, whereas a Holocaust certainly would be. Now, I don't know, you know, this is once again an assertion made by somebody other than me. And I tend not to speak about the Jews because of the dangers of very real dangers of anti-Semitism. But since Henry Mackow is a Jew himself, I like to point people to him and let them read him and figure out you know, what they think after they've assimilated his arguments. So I guess that shows you the range of what I'm trying to do in this book anyway.
Thank you very much for this. This has been a very enlightening and enjoyable conversation. I would love to have another conversation with you about paganism and neo-paganism, because that is something that interests me. And yet there is a conflict about this, or there are differences of opinions about this within the general traditionalist world. And I think that your opinions on this are fairly different from mine, and I think it would be productive for me to discuss this with you. So
it would be interesting.
Yeah.
As I say, paganism, you know, Northern European Druidism and Mediterranean paganism come from very deep roots, but they had degenerated over a very long period of time. And then when you get to the neo-paganism, which is, you know, Wicca being reinvented by Aleister Crowley and Gerald Gardner, you know, because they thought it would be a hoot, you know, that's a further level of degeneration than that.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a very enjoyable conversation, and I really do recommend to everyone listening to this to investigate Charles's book. It's called, again, Vectors of the Counter-Initiation, The Course and Destiny of Inverted Spirituality. It's out this year from Sophia Perennis, which is one of my favorite publishers because they publish not only Guenon's collected writings, but they also publish a lot of writers like Charles who are carrying on his tradition. The other book by Charles that I can recommend, because it's the only other one that I've read, is Who is the Earth? How to See God in the Natural World. That is another really interesting topic, dealing with spirituality and ecology.
Glad you read that. And actually, let me say, mention one more book, because you know, I grew up in California, but in 2004, me and my wife moved to Kentucky. I'm here in Lexington now. And so as part of the psychic assimilation to this area, because, you know, she grew up in Kentucky, I wrote a book called Folk Metaphysics, Mystical Meanings in Traditional Folk Songs and Spirituals. And this will deal, I mean, this has a lot to do with the genius of the white race, not in political terms, but in terms of you know, the kind of sentiments and the kind of knowledge that come through traditional folk songs, some of which I think were composed by the Christian Hermeticists as very specific metaphysical essays. I try to prove that in the book. And also, I deal to a point in there with paganism, because when people look back at folk materials, one of the things that they often look for is pagan survivals. Whereas I'm trying to get either back, either closer to us in time or back farther, and say, you know, the best of folk productions, whether they be tales or ballads or, you know, or various games and riddles, jokes, whatever they, however it appears, some of these go back directly to what René Guénon called the primordial tradition, which is the root of all the world religions. And so I try to show that.
Well, I'm going to go on Amazon right now and order that. That sounds absolutely fascinating to me. So do you deal with, say, Appalachian folk magic?
Well, yeah, actually one of the songs, you know, some of them I got from the child ballads, but there's a song called Fair Nottaman Town by Gene Ritchie, who we heard sing here in Whitesburg at the Apple Shop, some people may have heard of, which is sort of a little theater and community radio thing. And, you know, it's this song that's got a curse or a taboo on it, that anybody who finds out what it means will lose all his luck. And this is mysterious, you know, it goes, in Fair Nottaman Town, not a soul would look up, not a soul would look up, not a soul would look down. Not a soul would look up, not a soul would look down to show me the way to Fair Nottaman Town. And Gene Ritchie is one of the old, you know, folk revival, you know, grand old lady of the folk revival, you know, that also gave us Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. But she, you know, she comes back to her native soil once in a while, although she lives in New York, and sings the old songs. These songs passed her through her family. But then later, you know, when she got better known as a folk singer, she traveled to England and discovered that this was a version of a mummer song called Fair Nottingham Town from England. And it's an entire alchemical rendition of the spiritual path in seven stages. And it must have been composed by the Christian Hermeticists, because who else would do it? And it was, as Guénon said, these songs were composed by schools, esoteric schools, who were about to go out of existence, and so they committed their lore to folk memory, hoping that sometime in the distant future somebody would figure out what they were up to. And I think that's true. So, and it has a lot to do with, you know, the genius of the white race comes through those songs like nothing else.
Well, that sounds really fascinating, and I do have a great love of folk music, so that's something that I will definitely look into. How many books have you written?
I think there's about 17 now. Because I got this one publisher to publish anything I write. Because, you know, James Wetmore of Sophia Perennis, because he has to put out as many titles as he can, because he's doing this print-on-demand, labor-intensive, which means you don't have, you know, you don't invest money in a book you hope will sell. But since he's, you know, a dynamo of editing, you know, and publishing force, he just puts out as many titles as he can, and they all sell a little bit, and this keeps body and soul together for him. So it was really lucky for me, because, you know, if I'd gone any other way, none of these books would have appeared.
Right. Well, we do print on demand. We actually use the same company that you use to print most of our, that he uses to print our books. And it really has totally revolutionized publishing, I think. Much to the benefit of every idea that's a little out of the mainstream.
Yeah, sort of like the web. Everybody can have a website. Now everybody can publish a book in somewhat of the same way.
Yeah.
Which means that there's so many books you can't see the forest for the trees, but nonetheless, we can do what we're doing today.
Yes, and one of the things that very much impresses me, though, is the high quality of the editing and production of these books. Any fool can put out print-on-demand books, but...
Yeah, through Lulu.com or something, yeah.
These are very high quality. So thank you again.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, Charles, I just want to say that I found it profoundly interesting just to listen to the two of you have this conversation. I just wanted to throw out at the end, I don't want to start a whole new discussion on this, of course, but you know, I was questioning when you were going through and talking about psychedelics and how the government seems to have used those to... for the purposes of mind control and whatnot.
Yeah, and not just mind control of individuals, like, you know, creating a programmed killer, but also changing mass belief.
Right. But reconciling that with the uses of psychedelics through herbal medicine and shamanic rituals in traditional religion.
Yeah. Well, a lot of that is dealt with in my interview, because Samuel Bendix Sotillos brings all that up, and he says, you know, what about these shamanic religions? And I just tend to say, well, you know, DMT, you know, used by shamans in the Amazon is a lot different than DMT used by, you know, hippies in North America. Mm. You know, the set and the setting are radically different.
Yeah.
Well, great. Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I'm satisfied. I feel happy about it.
Well, great. Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you very much, Charles.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.